morning. This is a meeting of the title setting board. The date is April 4th, 2018. It's at 10:05 a.m. We're meeting in the Aspen Room at the Secretary of State's office. Title board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyert, Deputy Secretary of State, on behalf of Secretary of State Wayne Williams. To my left is Jason Gellender, designee of Sharon Eubanks, Office of Legislative Legal. To my right is Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and legal counsel to the board is Matt Grove from the Attorney General's office. Today we're meeting to on a few rehearings, and then we have two new titles. The first matter on the agenda is 2017-2018 number 161, policy changes pertaining to state income taxes. And Mr. Rogers, I believe you filed the...
Morning, Madam Chair. Trey Rogers here on behalf of the objector.
All right. And Mr. Gruskin, if you can just state for the record that your clients are here.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Mark Gruskin on behalf of the proponents, Mr. Leverage and Mr. Patterson, both of whom are in the room and who have signed their affidavits.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Rogers, if you want to, we all have your motion, but if you want to walk us through there, or I assume you have Mr. Gruskin's response, if you want to respond to that, that'd be fine too.
I have seen it, thank you. I'd like to start, of course, a single subject. And in particular, I'd like to focus on our second single subject argument.
Sure, go ahead.
So, since Tabor passed in 1992, debrucing language has become a standard provision for revenue raising initiatives in Colorado. The proponents fail to include it. In some cases, the revenue raised might have to be refunded, thus defeating the very purpose of the measure. That's why generally debrucing language doesn't create a second subject. Protecting funding from refund is necessarily improperly connected to the subject of most revenue-raising measures. So by way of example, consider a measure that would raise taxes to fund education. Without debrucing language, new tax revenue from that measure might be subject to Tabor refund, just like any other district revenue. Money over the limit may have to be refunded to taxpayers. In that case, the debrucing language that excludes the new revenue from the district's Tabor limit would prevent the district from exceeding its limit and thus being forced to refund the money intended for education. But 161 is different. It would raise taxes to fund tax credits, not new spending. For purposes of calculating district revenue, a tax credit results in a revenue reduction. So 161 would raise about $1.3 billion in new taxes, but it would result in almost the same amount of new tax credits. According to Ledge Council's fiscal impact statement, the result would be an increase in state revenue, potentially subject to Tabor refund, of only $28 million. That's on page 4. Only that $28 million could be subject to refund, and that only after the initiative's credits were fully funded. Now, that's an important point. It means that even without debrucing language, there is no risk that the purpose of the measure would be defeated by Tabor. In other words, debrucing language in 161 is not necessarily improperly connected to the subject of the measure. It is simply not necessary to protect that tax revenue from potential refund. Mr. Roper, you look, maybe I've said something that isn't clear. I might just pause there. Okay. Nonetheless, the proponents of 161 did include debrucing language. That's found on page 2 at section 3 and would be codified as 3922-104-1.8D. And note that the language would debruce all revenues attributable to the income tax rate imposed by the measure, not the net after the credits, but all revenue. So why is it included? It is not, again, in this case, properly or necessarily connected to the subject of the measure, as only a tiny fraction of the revenue raised could be subject to refund, and then only after the initiative's tax credits are fully funded. So why? Well, the answer is it's a second purpose. It's a second subject. The only result, the only impact, the only possible reason for including that debrucing language is to add an additional $1.3 billion in state spending authority. Remember, tax credits result in a revenue reduction. So as the revenue comes in, it's de-bruised, the tax credits reduce state revenue, and the result is an extra $1.3 billion in capacity under the cap for other spending. That is the only impact of this measure, or of this provision of the measure.
So let me just stop you so you can explain to me the difference. So you don't think all the time that it would be one issue to raise the tax and another issue to keep the money. You're saying because of the way this is structured. Because there are certainly keep raising the tax and keeping the money can be necessarily connected.
Yeah, I want to talk in a minute about the excess, but I would agree that if that raising money to fund spending and then including a debruising provision to make sure that money doesn't get refunded, I think that's all a single subject, yes.
Okay, so this is different because then, I guess.
That's right. But don't take my word for it. Ledge Council agrees. On page 6 of the fiscal impact statement, Ledge Council notes that, quote, the measure reduces state income tax revenue subject to Tabor, close quote. Ledge Council also notes that the measure would reduce state income subject to Tabor by $1.3 billion in FY20, that it would eliminate Tabor refunds in FY19 and FY20, and that it would allow an additional $1.3 billion per year, inflation adjusted into the future, in state spending without triggering a Tabor refund. All of this as a result of debruising language that is not necessary to the measure. This second subject hidden in the coils of the measure deprives this board of jurisdiction to set title. And by the way, this isn't a garter snake. This is a $1.3 billion anaconda. I'd like to pause there because this is a fairly complex issue and perhaps get this one resolved and if necessary, come back to the remaining arguments in the motion. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Gruskin, you want to come up and respond to that, or if you want to just rest on your motion?
Mark Gruskin for the proponents. The objectors have identified what they believe to be a purpose or a subject, but at best, it is an effect. And more realistically, it is a matter of conjecture in terms of how this will be interpreted and applied, which is far beyond the capacity of the board. Honestly, there is no such purpose in terms of taking spending authority and changing its levels. And the structure of the measure is such that it operates to increase taxes and then provide an outflow of those revenues for the purpose of the EITC. That's what it does. What the downstream likely to be litigated impact, which is neither expressed in the measure nor intended by the proponents, is a matter of sheer conjecture, and that's basically what you've heard. I'm happy to answer questions, but the suggestion here that the purpose is to change spending limits is just that, conjecture.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
No, okay. I think Mr. Rogers wants you.
So, Madam Chair, if I could, this is not an effect. But by way of contrast, if you take a look at the case cited by the proponents in their response to the motion, they cite a case in which a measure would have defined fee within Article 10, Section 20 of the Constitution. The objectors in that case argued that the ramifications of that definition of a fee would be wide-ranging, very broad. And the Supreme Court looked at that and said, no, it's a single subject. The single subject is increasing a fee. The fact that there may be effects or ramifications that are broad and wide-ranging isn't something that we're going to take up. That is not the case here. This is very different situation. Again, we don't have any disagreement about it. I didn't hear Mr. Gruskin disagree with how we describe the kind of impact of the measure.
Well, I thought he said it was just conjecture on your part as to how it would be interpreted.
That's all he said in a pretty conclusory way. I mean, look, Ledge Council looked at this and said, right, you're debruising the income. The tax credits will be a revenue reduction. The result will be wiping out the Tabor refunds in 19 and 20 and very likely in years after that. I mean, there's no mystery here. There's no question. Tabor's been around for, 26 years now. We know how it works. That's what's going to happen. But more importantly, there's no other reason to have this debruising language in the measure. This is not raise revenue and spend on a program. This is raise revenue, provide credits, which is a set off. This measure only generates $28 million in revenue that could be debruced, or that needs to be debruced, that could potentially be refunded. So why is it in there? It's a second subject. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, isn't it in there too, so that amount that is not captured in the offset can still be spent?
I'm glad you raised that. There are six measures here that we're going to get to today. In 61, all revenue collected is debruced. In 157, for instance, only the revenue, only the net is debruced. Only that $28 million is debruced. That's written differently. It says, you take the tax revenue, you take off the administrative costs, you take off the credits, and whatever's left, that revenue is debruced. So there is a way to do exactly what you've suggested might be the intent. But that's not what the proponents did in this case. In this case, they said, let's debruce all of the revenue, not the net, but all of the revenue. Ledge Council didn't struggle with it. Ledge Council said, right, that's going to wipe out our refunds. That's going to create an enormous additional spending capacity for the state under the Tabor limit. So, yeah, it could have been done. But again, it could have also been left out. If there's no debrucing language in this measure, you still there is no risk of a refund that would impact the ability to fund these tax credits.
Well, isn't then the second subject really the credit?
No.
Couldn't you do what they're doing? Without the credit? Because then you'd just be collecting and spending, right?
You need the credit.
You didn't have the credit? If you didn't have the credit, would it be one subject? Because you'd just be collecting and spending.
Well, I'm not sure what you'd be spending on without the credit. I mean, the credit is
you'd be collecting and debrucing.
Yeah, you'd just be collecting and debrucing for whatever anybody wanted to spend it on.
You would need to debruce. So, in other words, if this was just a $1.3 billion tax increase.
Right.
Right.
With no credit involved.
With no credit.
Would be single subject, right? Because you'd just be collecting and debrucing.
I think that's right. But again, the reason for that is without the debrucing in that circumstance, all or part of the $1.3 billion would be subject to refund. You know, if it caused the state to exceed its Tabor cap, all or part of that $1.3 billion would be subject to refund. That is not the case here.
Would it be subject to refund if you debruced it?
Well, without the debrucing language, it would be subject.
Okay.
So, in other words, you need the debrucing language if all you're going to do is raise $1.3 billion in taxes, right? Otherwise, the refund would defeat the purpose of the measure. In 161, you don't need it. It's got its own built-in revenue reduction measure in an amount equal to the tax increase. So the debrucing language necessarily does something else. And what it does is creates an additional $1.3 billion in spending. capacity.
So does your position mean with a tax increase like this, you have to choose between a tax credit or debrucing the additional revenue to satisfy single subject?
Yes and no. I mean, if you want to protect, in this case, there's $28 million projected to be left over. If you want to protect that, you'd need to do what the proponents did in 157, for instance, which is to debruce that little sliver of revenue.
But your position is you can't have an overlap of amounts that are, attributed to the tax credit and then also debruced.
Right. There must be a second purpose. It must be a second subject because there is no other reason to have it. The only reason to do it is if you want to create room under the Tabor cap. That's it. It achieves no other purpose.
Okay. Mr. Gruskin, did you want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Gruskin, for the record. My pen was scratching as Mr. Rogers was talking. And in his last set of comments, he called what he has termed a second subject the impact of the measure. That's what's going to happen. And what it does is, in other words, he found three synonyms for effect. And he used them all in his statement to you, but he protests that this can't possibly be an effect. When at review and comment, the proponents were asked whether or not what would happen if there was excess revenue over the amount of the tax credit. The response was, which we've repeated in our papers to you, is that it leaves room for the legislature to change the amount of either the credit or the threshold to provide for an EITC that is that fully uses the amount of revenue generated. But under the legal position taken by the objector here, you could never create a tax credit, ever, without having a second subject. Because what Ledge Council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services described to us is the way we had originally drafted this, which was as an expenditure, is inconsistent with what the auditor does, which treats any credit as a revenue reduction. So literally what's being proposed to you is that there is no such thing as a single subject tax credit that pays for itself. Because under the auditor's rubric, a credit has to be treated as a revenue reduction. And therefore, the only logical extension of the argument that's being made is that any tax credit that is formed this way, where there's revenue to pay for it, is always going to be a second subject. And that's nonsensical.
So do you need debrucing of the amounts that are sent out as the tax credit?
Could you ask me that one more time?
Yeah, so you have the increased tax that brings in this amount.
Right.
And then a portion of it it falls under this tax credit and is sent back out, to reduce revenue. Does that amount have to be reduced in order to be sent as the tax credit?
Does it have to be reduced?
Does it have
debruced?
To be sorry, debruced?
Right.
The conversation at review and comment suggested that it did.
Because I think Mr. Rogers is saying it doesn't, and therefore, when you debruce here in this measure and then those funds go away, you end up just with a huge, spending allotment that's unrelated to the funds that came in and were sent out as the tax credit.
Well, this is a never before litigated issue. And so to the extent that the proponents were to create a revenue source, create a tax credit and not debruce the revenue source, taking an extraordinary risk that a court would say the new tax revenue would have to be debruced. So the truth is there's no way to legally know the answer to your question. Everyone who we've talked to in the review and comment process, though, at no point was the suggestion made that debrucing was inappropriate or unneeded. It was simply, how do you do it best so that the auditor doesn't end up with a bookkeeping mess at the end of the year? So all of the input that we've received has been that the answer to your question is yes, you do have to debruce that amount.
So if it's never been litigated or decided, how are we supposed to decide whether that, I mean, if you're wrong, do you still think it is not a second subject to create a large additional spending authorization?
Well, it's a big if.
Okay.
And the presumption needs to be that as to whether or not this is a second subject or not, that's not the purpose of the measure. It may be an effect of the measure, but that's not the defining aspect for the single subject analysis. And do I think that an impact, a Tabor impact, is going to be a second subject? For instance, had the proponents just created a tax credit, then Mr. Rogers' analysis would apply as well. Anytime you create a tax credit, you're changing the law to do a particular thing. But if a revenue source hadn't been created, then all of that money would have been treated as a revenue reduction. Every single time under the analysis that's been suggested to you, there will be a second subject if a tax credit is proposed. And that has never been the analysis of the Supreme Court. I'll remind you that there are a series of cases from the 90s where tax credits were created for different taxes across the board at all levels with a variety of spending impacts, and never has the Supreme Court said that a tax credit, ipso facto, is a second subject because of its revenue impact. It's only when there's been a mandate to replace that, which this proposal does not do. It does just the opposite. It ensures that there won't be a cut in other funding. And therefore, it is totally consistent with the case law that does exist on tax credits in single subject. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I respond?
Sure, briefly? Go ahead.
I think if this debrucing language were necessarily and properly connected to the single subject, Mr. Gruskin may be right. This incidental impact on spending authority may be in effect. But that's not the case here. This debrucing language does nothing that is necessarily or properly connected to the single subject. It's a standalone piece of code that has only one result, and that is this creation of headroom under the cap. I just flatly disagree with Mr. Gruskin's argument that you could never have a tax credit, a tax increase with a tax credit within a single subject. First, take a look at 157. That's a very elegant solution. Let's just debruce the excess revenue over the amount of the credits, or don't include debrucing language at all. You've essentially got internal debrucing with the credit. You've got revenue coming in and you've got a revenue reduction. So there is no Tabor impact of a balanced, you know, tax increase with tax credit.
I think his argument is that's not necessarily true, because if a court looks at it as a revenue in, then whatever the revenue out is doesn't matter under the cap. I mean, the cap doesn't care about what goes out. The cap cares about what comes in.
It does care about it. Absolutely, it cares about it. When you take a tax deduction or you take a tax credit against your revenue, that's just money that the state never gets. That's why it's a revenue reduction. There is no mystery about this. Please don't let Mr. Gruskin mislead you into thinking that we're in some uncharted fiscal waters here. It is crystal clear. A tax credit simply reduces revenue. The state never gets it, and thus, if you have a tax increase and an offsetting credit, there is no Tabor impact. Take a look at the fiscal impact statement for 157. Ledge Council says no Tabor impact under this measure. The Tabor refund is exactly the same under 157 as it would be under current law. This is not, we're not in new territory here. I also briefly, Mr. Roper, wanted to...
But couldn't somebody, I mean, I'm not a tax expert, but couldn't somebody, you can get a credit, right, without even paying in? I mean, can't you, let's say you had no tax liability for the year, you would still get the credit under this initiative, wouldn't
you?
But you... Okay, so then you never... You weren't ever going to pay the tax.
But you're taking that down to an individual level.
Right.
This measure in gross balances, right? You've got $1.3 billion in revenue. You've got $1.3 billion in tax credits. That's the balance that matters for Tabor purposes. Again, I direct you to 157 in the fiscal analysis there. There is no Tabor impact because you've got a balancing between the income that's coming in and the credits that are going out. It doesn't move the Tabor needle and one iota.
So looking at that, I assume this is the sentence you're talking about. This is in the fiscal impact, initial fiscal impact statement for 157. Because the amount by which state revenue is expected to be reduced as a result of the new EITC exceeds the amount expected to be collected from the graduated income tax rate, the Tabor exemption in the measure is not expected to apply during the years estimated.
Yeah, that one works. What I was looking at was on page, well, yes, that's right. On page 6, the Tabor impact.
And that's the section I'm looking at. Maybe,
yeah, exactly.
Is there something else you'd point me to other than that language?
Well, I noticed also in that second paragraph, since the bill increases revenue to the general fund and the refund obligation by equal amounts, there is no net impact on the amount of money available in the general fund. Now, that's talking about the revenue side, but the same analysis applies in that previous paragraph on the Tabor limit side. You've got offsetting amounts of tax and credit, thus no Tabor impact.
And I apologize I for being a little slow here, but in 161, what is the language in the initial fiscal impact statement that you would point to talking about this creating a $1.3 billion spending amount above and beyond the tax credit?
You bet. That's on page 6 also. And that first paragraph under Tabor impact says the measure, this first paragraph tells the story. The measure reduces state income tax revenue subject to Tabor by expanding the EITC. Right, because the credit is a revenue reduction.
Okay.
The measure specifies that revenue collected via the graduated income tax is exempt from Tabor. Right, so I don't have an offsetting increase in revenue. I just have the reduction. Next, the net of the repeal, of the current EITC, the measure reduces state revenue subject to Tabor by $644 million in FY19, $1.3 billion in FY20, and $1.33 billion in 2021, FY21. That's it. And Mr. Roper, I wanted to go back to your question, if I could. You asked Mr. Gruskin, is it necessary to debruce? And again, the answer is found in 157. In 157, the proponents did not debruce all revenue. They only debruced the revenue that was excess of the tax credits. That is the answer. The answer to your question is no, there is no need to debruce. In addition, because they're offsetting, there's no need to debruce at all. The refund of that $28 million would in no way interfere with the single subject or the purpose of this measure. That $28 million, if it were refunded, that would only happen because the credits have been paid, or the credits have been given. And then finally, Mr. Roper, you asked, how do we decide this? My suggestion is trust-ledge counsel. They're telling you what the analysis is. And trust, they're telling you what the analysis is. And by the way, not the end of the world for these proponents if 161 doesn't get a title set. 157 is the answer. It's the same measure. There's one other minor difference, but it's the same measure, except the debrucing language is limited to the excess of the taxes over the credits. So they get to go forward with that measure. They just can't go forward with 161 because it's got this second subject.
Could I ask Mr. Gruskin if you have any comment or reaction to the initial fiscal impact statement for 161, that first paragraph under Tabor impact on page 6, which does seem to indicate that net of the tax credit, it still reduces revenue subject to Tabor by these amounts listed, 600 million, 1.3 billion, and 1.33 billion.
The answer to your question, Mr. Roper, is once I graduated with my economics degree in college, I stopped thinking like an economist. So I trust what Ledge Counsel says. I don't necessarily trust that that is how a court would evaluate it, because the revenue reduction that occurs would occur anyway. The $1.3 billion there's going to be a revenue reduction based on the debrucing of the cost of the tax credit. And therefore, the analysis from 157 has to apply here as well. Am I saying that they were right in one and wrong in the other? The general debrucing, as Mr. Rogers pointed out, really only applies to whatever increment might be left over. It doesn't apply to change the spending limit for purposes of the entire amount raised that is then sent out as a tax credit.
I may have to ask a question about that. I think, not to speak for Mr. Rogers, I think his argument is that that's exactly what it does. Now it says, here's an extra $1.3 billion sort of available for spend under the cap. Now what the measure doesn't do is actually create the money to spend there. But, you know, that then becomes a speculative question of effects. Does the General Assembly increase fees in other areas or find other ways to get more money to spend for other purposes? But that's not inherent in this initiative. But I think the room to do that appears to be inherent in this initiative. Am I wrong on that?
I mean, I struggle to wonder why the debrucing of all revenue as opposed to debrucing of under 157 what is functionally 98% or 99% of the revenue, why one creates spending cap capacity and the other doesn't. And you're probably in the very best position to explain to me why that's the case. But in both instances, you've got $1.3 billion or so that is created and either get and given back.
Right, but I think in this initiative, in 161, essentially the revenue that doesn't come in is Tabor revenue. I'm sorry, is yeah, this is really hard to, I know what I'm trying to say, I'm not sure how to say it. So we have a reduction regardless, if there's no tax increase whatsoever, we still have this great big revenue reduction.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have a debruced source to essentially pay for that reduction. So we sort of get the reduction twice, it feels like, giving you a lot more room, in theory, for other spending under the cap. Now, what is not created is the revenue to actually accomplish that spending, besides the $28 million or whatever the bit of overage, anticipated overage is, which I think is sort of an incidental effect. But it is a substantial difference, I think, between this and 157 and 159.
I hear your point. I'm not sure I agree, but I also don't think that we get to the inquiry of threading that Tabor needle without looking at what is, as you point out, a long-term effect that could or could not be funded and therefore whether it's ever used or not is not even just an effect, it's a conjectural effect.
Right. I'm just trying to make sure we're sort of in agreement on that there is, in terms of a spending cap, at least a hypothetical amount of room under the Tabor cap difference between these two and 157 and 159.
And I guess
then the next question becomes whether that is actually a single subject issue or not.
And I'm not willing to concede that that's actually the correct analysis here.
Okay. Thank you.
Or correct conclusion. I think the analysis is appropriate that you undertook.
Madam Chair, just one quick point on Mr. Gellender's inquiry. You know, the fiscal analysis answers your question in part. The projection is currently for a $10 million Tabor refund in FY19 and a $156 million Tabor refund in FY20. Those go away under this measure if it passes. So it's not really conjectural. There will be a real-world impact on this, at least until the quarterly estimates change again. Thanks.
Want to kick off the discussion?
If you want me to.
Sure.
I'm actually having a pretty hard time with this one, but ultimately, I think while I do believe there is on these two only, and as opposed to 165 and 166, where the same argument is made, but I think it's the potential impact's a little different, that this provides an opportunity for the General Assembly to, if it raises additional money from other sources, which could be fees or whatever, spend a lot more money than the voters might think on the face of this would be the case. Does that rise to the level of a second subject and coiled in the folds and all those things that are the limits of our jurisdiction? I'm having a harder time with that. I think these arguments, Mr. Rogers' arguments, are very good arguments for the Blue Book. I'm not convinced that they quite rise to the level of a single subject. You know, I don't think they're like the Outselt v. Bruce cases where it's truly something that people can't be anticipated. I won't anticipate. I think there are arguments for the campaign, arguments to be put in the Blue Book, and for people to know based on the next forecast if perhaps, you know, immediate refunds might not be happening. So it's a pretty fairly close question for me on this, but I'm leaning towards denying the motion on single subject grounds.
So it's close for me as well. Although I'm probably leaning a little more the other way towards finding that it is a second subject that's not necessarily and properly connected to, you know, I'm looking at how we described the purpose in the title, and it's increasing taxes by this amount and offsetting it with the tax credit, and then this appears. And I won't pretend to understand all the intricacies, but trusting the, you know, if we were to trust the fiscal impact statement, it does appear to say this creates room of an additional, you know, large amount, 1.3 billion in the a couple of upcoming fiscal years for additional spending unconnected, as far as I can tell, with the tax credit or with these funds that come in, the increased revenue that is then distributed through the tax credit. So because it doesn't seem necessarily connected, I'm leaning towards considering that to be a separate subject of the measure.
And that's, I think, closer to where I am. It's not that I don't think the voters could be educated or not surprised. I think it's that there would be voters that might agree with one principle and not the other, and this is kind of doing two different things. They might not mind increasing taxes and allowing the legislature to spend it, but they don't like the offset, or they might not mind the offset, but they don't want this kind of spillover provision. And so even though I think we could maybe fix some of that in the title to make it more clear, I don't think we can fix the fact that there are a couple different things going on here. And so I think I'm leaning toward Mr. Roper's position. So you should probably be the one to make that motion then.
Yeah, unless, Jason, if you have any other...
No. The only thing I would say is I think I'd be probably with both of you if this also brought in, like, right now a bunch more money, which it really doesn't. I mean, it does bring in a bit, but it's kind of incidental as they're trying to target a balance. And because of that, and I think the intervening steps that would be necessary for the General Assembly to actually spend a bunch more money is why I'm leaning the way I do. But again, so it's close, and I'm just putting that on the record.
And I understand that, and I think that's a good point. I would counter it a little bit with the fiscal impact statement saying that it will have the concrete effect, and I know here we're talking effects, but I think it does go to the second subject analysis, that it would eliminate refunds for the next couple of years that would otherwise happen under Tabor. So I think that does, all of that that we've talked about and Suzanne mentioned does convince me it's a second subject. So I'll move that for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 161, we conclude that it consists of more than one subject, and so I move that we grant the motion for rehearing on that basis.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, so that passes 2-1, and the motion for rehearing is granted, which takes us to 2017-2018 number 162.
Madam Chair, Thomas Trey Rogers for the objector.
Mr. Gruskin, your proponents are still present, I assume? And you admit to that, Mr. Rogers?
Yep. Agreed.
Okay. Why don't you walk us through this one?
Madam Chair, this is a measure that is substantially identical to 161, except that it's got a higher marginal tax rate that kicks in at a higher threshold. So I would simply incorporate my arguments from 161, unless there are further questions.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Gruskin, you want to let us know if you think there's anything different about that? And just
I'd likewise make my record based on the comments raised in 161 and agree with Mr. Rogers' synopsis of this measure.
So for the same reason as in the discussion of 161, I move that for 2017-18 initiative number 162 that we grant the motion for rehearing on the grounds that it contains more than one subject.
Second. And all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. So that passes 2-1, which takes us to 2017-2018 number 157.
Madam Chair, happy to go to 157. 165 and 166 may be a better place to go next if there's no objection from Mr. Gruskin or the chair.
That's fine. Well, let's go to 2017-2018 number 165.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 165 is substantially identical to 161 with one difference, and that difference is that monies attributable to the tax under 165 must be spent on the credit. That's the only difference I've found. And so I think that the arguments from 161 apply with equal force here with regard to single subject. And I would simply incorporate my arguments from 161 here unless there are further questions.
All right. Mr. Gruskin.
Mr. Rogers is correct about the text here. There is a must be used requirement here for the revenue generated, so it simply can't be used on any other expenditure source. We think that is material to your single subject decision and would incorporate our comments from 161 and ask you to find a single subject.
I'm sorry, did you say you think that is or is not material?
Is.
Okay.
Is.
In what way?
In that basically the entire revenue increase is dedicated to this credit revenue reduction. To the extent that that's the case, we believe that there is no capacity to use the revenue reduction as an excuse for increasing spending.
So you wouldn't have that $28 million that we were talking about, right, but you'd still have the debrucing of the full amount. Okay, right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would just point to the fiscal impact statement for 165 on page 6 under Tabor impact. We have identical language to the language for 161, which demonstrates that the fiscal analysis is exactly the same for 165 as it is for 161. Thanks.
So I think this one's different, but not in a way that eliminates my concern about second subject.
Yeah, I'd agree. So if you want to incorporate our comments from 161, and then also for the record, the proponents are still present. Do you want to make a motion?
Sure. So I move that for proposed initiative 2017-18, number 165, that we grant the motion for rehearing on the grounds that it does not satisfy single subject.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So that takes us to 166.
Madam Chair, Thomas Rogers for the objector, Denise Burgess. And I'll stipulate that the proponents are still present. 166 is identical to 165, except it's got a higher marginal rate that kicks in at a higher threshold. So I would incorporate my agreements from 161 and 165 and rest on that unless there are questions.
We'll incorporate Mr. Gruskin's same arguments from 161 and 165 and the board's comments. Mr. Gruskin, is there anything else you wanted to add? Okay. It's a no, so do you want to make a motion?
Yes, I'll move for proposed initiative 2017-18, number 166, that we grant the motion for rehearing on the grounds that it does not satisfy single subject.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Passes 2-1. All right, that takes us to 157.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thomas Rogers for the objector, Denise Burgess. I'll stipulate the proponents for 157 remain in the room. The objector does not have a single subject argument on 157. Instead, we have concerns about the language of the title in three regards. This is a measure that repeals the existing Colorado Earned Income Tax Credit and replaces it with something new. It is different in several material respects from the existing Earned Income Tax Credit. First, this credit is available to individuals with no income. That is a change in law, and yet that change is not reflected in the title. To avoid a misleading title, that provision of the measure should be referenced. Second, under the measure, individuals are entitled to receive an actual refund check. That is not the case under the current EITC in Colorado. That's a change in law, and it is not reflected in the title. It should be to avoid a misleading title. And third, the title uses the phrase earned income tax credit, calls it an expanded earned income tax credit. An expanded state earned income tax credit. That is a misnomer. The earned income tax credit suggests that to obtain the credit, the individual must earn income. That is not the case under this measure. In fact, individuals that earn no income may be entitled to the credit. So the reference, the couple of references in the title to the earned income tax credit are misleading and should be replaced with a more accurate description of the program that the measure would create. Happy to take any questions.
And what would that be?
Not up to me, Madam Chair, but expanded earned income tax credit is misleading.
Okay. All right, Mr. Gruskin.
Mark Gruskin on behalf of the proponents. Not up to me pretty much says it all. This is not a change that we think is essential based on any of the three points raised. However, rather than allow not up to me to be the only response you've got, we're willing to make certain changes to accommodate the objector and to take these issues off the table for the objector's likely Supreme Court appeal. In the first instance, if the board wishes to put in a provision that says that there are certain taxpayers with low or no income who will qualify, we don't object to that language. We think it would probably best be used on at the end of line 12 after students, say with low or no income, a phrase of that sort. In addition, Mr. Rogers basically makes the same argument twice. He says that this credit will be given to people with no income, and therefore earned income tax credit is not accurate because it doesn't relay the fact that it will be, that this funding will be given to people, certain individuals with no income. But that's exactly the same. His first and third arguments are just different ways of saying exactly the same thing. So we think that if the board addresses it one way, it doesn't have to say it the other way. On the other hand, if Mr. Rogers has some other phrase other than what is used in the measure for earned income tax credit, and how it would be referred to in the tax code, we would be open to listening to that. And finally, his third argument, which is really his second argument, is that this ought to be clear that it is being paid monthly. Well, we don't think that's a central feature. Why make the Supreme Court address it if it doesn't have to? So we would not object on line 12 after $2,000 to add the phrase, which may be paid out monthly. Let's make Mr. Groh's life easy.
Well, where would the language that you were saying, even if, you know, regardless of income, you're saying that would only, that would go on line 12 and apply just to the caregivers and students?
Correct.
It doesn't apply unless you're a caregiver or student?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the other one on line 12, you would just put in, which may be paid monthly after 2000? Is that what you said?
Which may be paid out monthly, or which may be paid monthly, yes, whatever. And I'm not sure regardless of income is exactly right.
Right.
Could we just say with incomes from zero to 70,000 or something?
I don't know. I would suggest something like, even if they do not have earned income.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
With the monthly language added, which I'm not sure that we need, I'm worried, though, that as it reads there, it indicates that there'd be $2,000 payments coming monthly.
Okay. And that would need to be...
Yeah, on that, I would personally, in the interest of brevity and notwithstanding the agreement of proponents and opponents that they don't really mind the language, I don't think this is a central feature at all, and I would leave it out entirely.
Yeah, I would too.
And just so the record's clear, we're not agreeing that this is a material aspect. We're simply trying to make the briefs to the Supreme Court that much shorter. Because
yeah, it's just not a detail we would generally put in.
And before us is the title, which we also tend to like to make shorter. So
yeah,
I agree.
Thank you.
Okay, so the only addition is on line 13 after students, we have even if they do not have earned income.
Yes, and I don't know, and just maybe just for the record, with regards to the third argument, that the use of the phrase earned income tax credit is misleading, I would just say that I think it's in the main not misleading to the extent it could be. It would only be with this issue that we've addressed with the additional language.
Right.
So that we don't need to do anything else.
Right.
Could I just ask, Mr. Rogers, do you agree that the qualifying caregivers and students are the only individuals who could benefit from the credit if they had no income?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
What are you looking for? Motion to just adopt as it appears, or you want to read it first? Or
I think we can just adopt it as it appears because we only made that one change.
All right. I would move that we grant the motion for rehearing only to the extent that we've added a bit of language to the title as it now appears on the screen, and that we deny the motion in all of the respects.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That takes us to 2017-2018, number 159.
Madam Chair, Trey Rogers for the objector, Denise Burgess. 159, I believe, is identical to 157, except that it's got a different marginal rate and a different threshold. So I would simply incorporate my arguments with regard to 157 here. I would also stipulate that the proponents remain present, unless there are questions.
Mr. Gruskin, do you have anything?
Madam Chair, on behalf of the proponents, I too would incorporate the comments made earlier on initiative 157.
Okay, so incorporating our comments from 167, then the change would again be line 13. After students, we would add even if they do not have earned income. Does anybody have anything?
I think you may have said 167. I think you mean 157.
Oh, yeah.
Our comments from 157.
Yeah. All right. With that, I move that we grant the motion for rehearing only to the extent that we've changed the title as just described.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That actually takes us to...
New stuff.
Yeah. Proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 167, authorizing bonds for transportation projects. The proponents could come forward, state who you are for the record.
Hello, I'm John Caldera, proponent for 167, and here is Mike Kraus, the other proponent.
Mike Kraus, proponent for 167.
Mr. Caldera, you submitted essentially the same, or maybe you can tell me if it's different, but this looks a lot like number 21 from last year.
It looks exactly like the one from last year. This is the exact same proposal, we'll be bringing it forward this year.
Okay. So with that, do you have any comments on the single subject, or I guess it's actually like 122.
I think it was 120, whatever.
No, yeah, number 22.
21 and 22?
Maybe. Yeah, 21 and 22. All right. Did you have any comments on the single subject, or?
Only all the things that I said a year ago
okay.
still count, that this is a single subject.
All right.
So for brevity, I'll just say that.
All right. Any questions from the board? Make a motion.
Is there anyone else?
Oh, yeah. Is there anybody signed up to speak on this one? No.
Okay. I would move that we find that proposed initiative 2718 number 167 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. So looking at results for proposed initiative 22 last year, the language of the title setting is
not exactly the same.
Yeah.
And let me put forward our argument. As exactly like last year, we were facing a situation where there might be several competing measures on the ballot dealing with transportation funding. The reason this initiative exists, 167, is to bond without increasing taxes. That is the main feature of this initiative. And I would respectfully ask that the board put in the exact same language as they did a year ago, making it clear that this does not raise taxes. I believe it was put shall taxes be increased up to $3.5 billion without raising taxes, comma, with a maximum repayment cost. I think everything else was pretty much the same.
The measure actually says without raising taxes or fees. You want the
oh, that's right,
fees
without raising taxes or fees.
So that would go after the 5.2
uh-huh.
billion.
That's where it was last year, although it didn't say.
No, actually,
fees.
I think it was. Wasn't it right after the $3.5?
Nope.
No,
after right after the 52.
Well, it should be right after the 3.5.
And it actually just said taxes.
But I believe the language, and it might be a change that we did from last year, on page 1, 43.4. 1102 section B without raising taxes or fees. So I think it would be appropriate to put in without raising taxes or fees from the language.
Any comment from the board on that?
I think that that's fully appropriate.
Okay. And then the other thing we had last year was throughout the state at the end, in case anyone was confused about
oh, that's right.
where the money would be spent. Do you want
and
that
I would
again?
Ask that that be added as well.
Okay. We didn't have a rehearing on this last year, did we?
I don't believe we did.
I think so.
We did, but it was minor language changes. I'm
oh,
not
okay.
sure. Was this the one we got a number wrong or something, maybe? I don't know, but
oh,
I
maybe.
Think we...
We did something on it.
Did.
Word. Yeah, there were rehearings with changes, slight changes to the title.
Okay.
I recall, and I've got the memory of a 98-year-old, it was not a substantial change that we made. It was something very minor.
Okay. This is a minor thing. I think on line one, and this is a little difficult because I know the measure technically says I can go up to 3.5 billion, and it's not that it has to be exactly 3.5 billion, but Tabor actually mandates the language we have to start this from. And it is shall, you know, district debt, so shall state or state debt shall be increased, and there's no by or up to, and I think we should stick with that just because it's specifically stated in the Constitution.
So by after increase?
Yeah, it should just be shall, well, it's debt, it just should say debt be increased instead of by up to.
So you'd take out the by up to from the staff draft?
Yeah. Yes.
That's in, yeah, that wasn't in last year. So.
Correct.
Yeah.
And for the same reason.
There was a small technical change in the wording of the actual language so that if the legislature had extra money that they wanted to use and I believe use a little less debt, so that's why we put into buy up to somewhere. But I have no problem with that change here. I think that's...
The other question is the with 20-year terms was not specified last year on line four. I don't know if... To me, it's not necessarily central. If the proponents want it in there, I wouldn't object to it, but I'm just raising that.
I don't find it necessary.
Yeah, I didn't last year. I guess I don't. Yeah. This year. Take it out?
Yeah, I think so.
You want to accept them, Steve, and I'll read it in. So right now it's state debt shall be increased 3.5 billion with a maximum repayment cost of 5.2 billion without raising taxes or fees by a change to the Colorado revised statutes requiring the issuance of transportation revenue anticipation notes and in connection therewith. Note proceeds shall be retained as a voter-approved revenue change and used exclusively to fund specified road and bridge expansion, construction, maintenance, and repair projects throughout the state.
All right. I would move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18, number 167, as has just been read and appears on the screen.
Second.
And did we do single subject?
Yes.
Okay. And all those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 163, setback requirements for oil and gas.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the title board. Martha Tierney here on behalf of the proponents for initiative 163, Suzanne Cabral and Russell Mendel, who are both present and have signed their affidavits.
All right. And is there anyone else signed up on this?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Ms. Turney, do you want to just tell us the difference between this one and the, I don't remember what number it was that we set?
97. Yeah. Sure. So the primary differences are in the 97 had a 2D that was a definition of local government, and also in 2C, the definition of vulnerable areas had a phrase that is not in 163 regarding additional vulnerable areas designated by the state or local government. And then 97 also had a subsection 4 about allowing state or local government to require that new oil and gas development be located a larger distance from occupied structures. Those are the differences.
Okay.
Generally, there's also a change in section three, where it now in 163 says from the nearest occupied structure instead of from an occupied structure.
Do you believe that matters for title setting?
I really don't. I don't think it matters substantively, really, but the legislative council suggested it, and we just decided to make that change.
Okay. All right. Let's start. Anyone have any questions on a single subject?
No.
Okay. I'm gonna make a motion.
I would move that we find the proposed initiative 2017-18 number 163 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
So do you have any comments on the staff draft?
So let me just pull up for one moment the... And so this, to your question, Mr. Gallander, does say the nearest structure in the title. No, we don't have any... concerns about the title, the staff draft as written.
Because other than the change from any to the nearest, all it's done is deleted language from the 97 title regarding local government stuff, right?
Correct.
My only question would be whether, if we're going to say the nearest, which I guess now tracks the measure, if we want to put a from after and on line four, just because somehow the lack of parallel between the nearest structure and any is, I don't know, it's just reading slightly odd to me.
Okay.
That's fine.
All right. So right now it reads a change to the Colorado revised statutes concerning a statewide minimum distance requirement for new oil and gas development and in connection therewith changing existing distance requirements to require that any new oil and gas development be located at least 2,500 feet from the nearest structure intended for human occupancy and from any other area designated by the measure.
All right. I move we set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 163 as has been read and now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I have a question for Stephen on this one. Have we received the initial fiscal impact statement?
Yes, we received both fiscal impact statements yesterday. I thought that I forwarded them both to the
you
board.
Did.
But
you probably did. Thank you.
I had one more question, Stephen, for you. I didn't see, as I was looking on the Secretary of State's website today for the fiscal from 97 to compare it, 97's not on your list, or at least I couldn't find it on the web.
You can check that right now.
I found it somewhere else. I found it in Ledge Council, but just so you...
I think I see it.
There it is right there.
Oh. Never mind.
All right.
Under awaiting Supreme Court review. That's where I looked for it. And it is before the Supreme Court, but.
Okay. We'll get that corrected today.
Okay. All right. I think that's everything we had on the agenda. We don't have any.
One thing. Just the reason why it is not under awaiting Supreme Court action is because the proponents pulled a petition.
Sure.
And so the approved circulation status trumps the Supreme Court status.
Got it. Okay.
All right. That concludes our agenda. The time is 11:20, and we are adjourned.